The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. And today's program will focus primarily on one performance coming up, and that is by William Kinderman, who is giving a recital of music by Beethoven and Brahms on Thursday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. That concert starts at 7:30. He's professor of musicology, actually, at the University of Illinois, but also a very fine pianist. Stay tuned. It's live and local. That was the first of the seven fantasies, Opus 116, by Johannes Brahms, a performance by Emanuel Acts, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And you can hear all seven fantasies in performance by William Kinderman on Thursday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. He's doing that complete set, which is from the end, near the end of the career of Brahms. He's also going to be doing some of the music from early in Brahms's career, his Opus 10 ballades, as well as the very last of the 32 piano sonatas of Ludwig von Beethoven, which he has himself recorded, and we'll hear from those in just a minute. Professor Kinderman, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
It's great to be here, as always, Kevin.
So I have occasionally been in conversation with a couple of different musicologists about what often seems to be a divide between research and performance. There seem to be an awful lot of people who study, teach, and work in the realm of musicology, but don't actually perform anything. And then there is what may or may not be a growing number of people such as yourself who are very active performers and make quite a point of it. I guess I'm most familiar with the ones in the early music movement, many of whom started out as musicologists and came to end up performing as well. What's your take on that divide, if there even is one?
I'm afraid there is a strong divide, but I'm strongly, even passionately committed to the idea that it's a good idea to blend research and performance, scholarship and practical musical experience, and that they will enrich one another if these two aspects that are often kept apart, especially in our highly institutionalized world and in the compartmentalized world of universities today, if we try to overcome that division.
Why do you think it got divided in the first place?
I think that it has something to do with the development, especially in the 20th century, of sub-disciplines of study. So that even in a relatively small field like scholarship on music, we often can observe a division between historians and theoreticians. Analysts don't have much to do with the people who study history, let alone the problem of connecting to the world of performance, in which many performers are very occupied with the practical business of playing, but don't have that much time to devote themselves to study about those works and aesthetic challenges that they're confronted with.
So at the University of Illinois, for example, you have, I'm not sure exactly what they're termed, but you have the division of theory and composition, then you have the division of musicology, and then you have
the performance
all of the
divisions.
Many people working in performance specific to their instrument, which narrows it down even farther.
But the guiding idea is supposed to be the integration of fields, and that's the reason that students in the DMA or Doctor of Musical Arts program prepare documents as well. And it's my feeling that their playing will benefit if their documents are on a high level and if they do genuine research. And that, of course, is not only concerned with facts, It's also concerned with aesthetics and analysis.
So it's maybe a little ironic that we expect the students who come here, particularly if they're working in towards the doctorate, to integrate all of these things from professors who are separate.
There's a bit of a paradox there. I would be all in favor of encouraging bridges between the divisions and knocking down some of the walls that separate them.
So how long have you always had an active performing career yourself?
I've always tried to maintain it. When I was myself in graduate school, especially when I spent a couple of years at Yale University, I discovered quickly that it was best to conceal from my professors in musicology my performing interests.
Why?
Because they thought then that my commitment to scholarship would not be wholehearted enough.
I probably shouldn't even laugh because that's probably pretty common.
I think it's quite common.
I actually applied to Yale once for I'm sorry to say this, I didn't get in, but for a doctorate in conducting. And even though I knew, and this is, again, a different irony maybe, that at least the conducting professor at the time, and I'm not sure who's there now, it might be the same person, placed a very strong emphasis on piano skills for the conductor. So if you were a conductor without a strong piano background, you wouldn't get in, which seems the opposite of what you're saying, at least with that particular program that you were in at that particular time.
Yeah, although piano skills don't hurt. Maybe it was Werner Müller.
No, it was, Leighton Smith.
Yeah, one reason I went to Yale, I applied first to the Department of Music for musicology or music history, but also to the School of Music for piano. And I was attracted to Yale precisely because it had both a performing school and a tradition of scholarship. When I got there, however, I discovered that there was a long tradition of those divisions feuding that went all the way back to the period around the 1940s,
wow,
when Leo Schrader was the musicologist of note and Paul Hindemith was a leading figure in the School of Music, and the two of them didn't see eye to eye.
Yeah, what would they feud about? I mean, why do musicians feud? That's a whopping question.
It would probably take us too far afield, but maybe another time we should explore that.
Yeah, because, I mean, that would be interesting. That would be a really interesting several-part series. Who knows? The feathers would fly, probably, if we got that going. But, you know, it's something that has always puzzled me. You hear about academic politics in every field of academics, and I've always thought it strange that in a field like music, what is there to be political about? But I guess people find things, don't they?
They find things. Now, the very first of these four ballades that Johannes Brahms wrote when he was barely past 20 involves a serious conflict as well.
And you're going to tell it to us.
Yes. It's based on the old folk ballade that he knew from Herder's version, known as the Edward Ballade, that has three protagonists. And Brahms, who at this and at later points in his career was deeply interested in symbolism, absorbed this into his music. In brief, it concerns the relationship between a mother and a son, and the mother has egged on the son to kill his father. And she questions him as to what has happened, and he at first doesn't want to admit what he's done. And then in the center of the piece, the music is slowly built to an overpowering climax at the point that it changes key from D to B flat is the point where we can assume the act of patricide occurs. And it dissolves then into a deeply felt, tormented, tragic coda in which evidently the protagonist realizes that his act of assertion was actually a grim mistake. And it's striking that Brahms was attracted to this theme precisely in the context of having replaced Robert Schumann in the family constellation of the Schumanns. As a young musician, he had been introduced to the Schumanns in the fall of 1853. In January of 1854, Robert Schumann threw himself in the Rhine in a suicide attempt. He was then in an asylum. Brahms took over the role of the father figure, Schumann, in a practical vein, and had a very warm relationship also with Clara Schumann in the following months, and ultimately distanced himself, but was clearly deeply torn over that issue. And I think in that complex human context, it's fascinating to see that he was so drawn to this grim Edward Ballade.
Let's hear at least part of it. Perhaps we'll hear the whole thing in a performance. I didn't actually ask you which of these you prefer, but this is one featuring Earl Wilde as a pianist, the first of the four ballades, Opus 10. You can hear all four on William Kinderman's program at the Krannert Center Thursday night at 7:30. He's my guest on Live and Local. Powerful music by Johannes Brahms, inspired by a powerful story. It's called the Edward Ballade, his first of four ballades, Opus 10. We heard it played by Earl Wilde, and you can hear it played along with the other three by William Kinderman Thursday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Our broadcast today on Live and Local is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's musical heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. Bill, you mentioned, you were in telling the story of that both the story that inspired Brahms, the specific ballade, and then also his own personal history with his mentor Schumann, and then sort of taking over as the father figure, so to speak, even though he was quite young, is, I assume, that's the sort of information that you would expect if you were teaching a young pianist, that they would find out and absorb before they were going to play a piece like this.
But it doesn't happen automatically. And some of the cultural contexts that are quite important for this music need to be taken from sources other than the scores themselves. Another example could be found in a piece like the third of the four ballades of Opus 10, because we know that this piece, a scherzo-like 6-8 piece in B minor that closes in B major, this is bound up with Brahms's great enthusiasm for the romantic writer E.T.A. Hoffmann, who was a very influential figure. Of course, he's the one whose story, The Nutcracker, was taken up in various forms, including the ballet that is so often done with Tchaikovsky's music. And Brahms, at this point in his career, dubs himself Johannes II, or Chrysler II, played with the idea that he himself was a kind of reincarnation of this brilliant but rather deranged artist figure, Johannes Chrysler, or Johannes Circler, who was a key figure in E.T.A. Hoffmann's imaginative stories. And during that period in the spring and summer of 1854, when he was writing these pieces, he often spent evenings with Clara Schumann, and they read the most adventurous of all Hoffmann's novels called growler tomcat or cotter moor. And that also gives us a key to understanding the this rather strange scherzo-like piece that he calls intermezzo between the second and fourth ballades. The term intermezzo surely also applies to the connection between the preceding piece and the one that follows. In other words, an intermezzo has a connection to what precedes it and what will go after it. And that points to the fact that all of these pieces are closely interconnected. They're all one bigger narrative. But the character of Kreisler, with this rather wacky quicksilver but brilliant kind of capricious character, is captured in the main section, and then in the very strange a chime-like middle section with these sounds in the highest register, that is evidently connected to a passage in the novel Cotter Moor, where two of the protagonists are listening for the presence of the spirit of the deceased Kapellmeister Kreisler. So you have the presence of Kreisler in the outer scherzo sections, and then this mysterious presence in the center section. That's probably connected to the rather ghostly, slightly sinister treatment of the scherzo material in the last part of the piece. And then that takes us to a kind of monologue in the final piece. Brahms himself, when he was composing it, described it as maybe a minuet question mark going to or wedded to a sarabande, also question mark. And it's a fascinating andante movement that retains throughout this mood of brooding and reflection. The sarabande part is very deeply felt and touches a very tragic tone in the last section. And then the music finally makes a consoling shift to B major at the end, which was probably also a consoling experience when Brahms played these pieces, as he often did, for Clara Schumann around June and July of 1854.
Mm. Well, let's hear the third of the ballades, the one you were describing first. And this is a different performer now. This is Wilhelm Kempff, which I believe is from a live performance that he gave in London in 1972 here on Live and Local. The four ballades, again, will be heard in performance Thursday night live by William Kinderman at the Krannert Center in Urbana. He's my guest on Live and Local. It was the third of the Opus 10 ballades. A ballade is simply a ballad, and as Professor Kinderman has made clear, ballad in the poetic sense, in that they're telling stories. The first one especially, but the others as well. That was a performance by Wilhelm Kempff, and you can hear Professor William Kinderman play on Thursday at the Krannert Center, all four of those, and then also music from quite late in Brahms's life when he wrote many very short piano pieces, most of them, including the Opus 116 Fantasies, a set of seven intermezzos and caprices that will be on that program as well. That'll be in the first half of the concert, but the second half taken up by the very last of Ludwig van Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas. And that is a fascinating listen if you ever decide to go from beginning to end, you know, in listening to the sonatas, because by the time he gets to the end, he famously couldn't hear anymore, and a lot of people thought the guy had gone bonkers in writing some of the things that he wrote, including this piece, where there's some absolutely beautiful writing, but also you wonder what was he thinking technically when he was trying to make the piano do some of the things he was trying to make the piano do. What's your take on this whole piece?
No doubt he was searching for some sounds that had never been created in that way before. That's especially evident in the second movement, but already the first is very remarkable, in some ways quite extreme. In this case, Beethoven is content with just two movements, but he sets them up as a duality in opposition to one another. And it's the last time he uses his famous key of C minor, the key of the Fifth Symphony, the Funeral March of the Eroica, and the Sonata Pathétique, a key that is especially associated with Beethoven's tempestuous C minor mood. And the maestoso slow introduction to the first movement resembles most in its double-dotted rhythms, trills, and series of dissonant diminished seventh chords the setting of the Crucifixion in the Missa Solemnis that Beethoven wrote around the same time. That takes us via a very deep trill in the lowest register of the piano into the main part of the movement, which in some ways resembles the four-note motive that also appears in some of the late string quartets that the Pacifica Quartet has been traversing in their recent concerts. In this case, bom, 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 bom. In other words, the dissonant diminished seventh, whose pitches are adjacent to the C minor tonic triad. And Beethoven develops this with great force, yet there are moments in the first movement in which this darker mood is broken by glimpses of lyric sunshine, so to speak, especially in the last section, in which the music turns to the brighter sound of C major, and it actually closes with a kind of gateway to the key of C major and to the longer second movement, a series of variations or transformations on an arietta, as Beethoven puts it, or a little song. And this is justly famous, I think, as one of the most remarkable of all Beethoven's variation movements in his later years.
Does it, it seems a little, I want to use the term ironic again, which might not be the right word, that in this very last movement of all of his piano sonatas, which span pretty much his whole career, that he would take such a tiny theme and which would seem trivial,
that's,
and turn
that's
it into
very
something.
Good, very good point to raise. It's interesting that when Beethoven was in the process of writing the piece, for a long time the theme looked very different. The theme was a more flowing melodic inspiration, more dance-like in 3/8 time, and the material or the idea from his sketches goes not so much into the final version of the arietta, which is a slow chorale-like setting, but into the first and second variations. So one asks, well, what is Beethoven after here? And I think it's a very interesting concept that he's following. Beethoven makes the opening theme very slow in order that each of the following transformations can change it by adding new voices, and above all by gradually changing the rhythm so that we have more notes, and so that the dotted rhythm from the theme itself is systematically developed with almost mathematical precision. That means that by variation 3, the theme has been astonishingly transformed. Instead of being placid and reflective, it sounds jazz-like and radically agitated. And but what Beethoven is really after here are the stages that go beyond that, because the question can be raised: if we take any musical configuration and we keep increasing the speed, what will the outcome be? Well, from Beethoven's perspective in his later years, there is a logical and aesthetically valuable outcome to this. The music can focus on trills, which represent a kind of pulsation. In other words, a very rapid movement that can still sound and stand for an inner stillness. And so in the later stages of the movement, there are two celebrated passages with extended trills. The first of them actually has three trills all at once at a climactic point. And the coda brings a situation in which the music has ascended to the highest register of the instrument. A trill sounds on high G and A. Under it, the original theme has ascended to the lofty peak of the instrument, and below that, the left hand has some mesmerizing triplet figuration that endow the transformation of the theme with an uncanny transfigured aura. And it's rather as if this utopian symbol at the end of the sonata balances, if it doesn't overcome, the mood of tragedy from the first movement with which the piece had begun.
Well, you will have to go hear William Kinderman on Thursday to hear the complete piece, to hear all this integrated, you know, as you go from a description of the music and also an understanding of the theory behind it and some of the things that you were talking about early on that you would expect a performer to dig up and learn about, even if, in fact, most don't. And you can hear how it all comes out. We're going to play for you the complete second movement, the complete arietta, in William Kinderman's own recorded performance on the Helios label of the Piano Sonata number 32 in C minor of Beethoven, opus 111. It will be the closing piece on his recital at the Krannert Center Thursday night, starting at 7:30. And I appreciate very much your taking the time and talk with us today on Live and Local.
Thank you, too, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
And that's Beethoven's last word on the piano. Literally so. The final movement of the final sonata of his wonderful, epic 32 sonata output, the sonata number 32 in C minor, opus 111. William Kinderman was the pianist. We heard the second movement only. You can hear the complete sonata as well as numerous pieces by Johannes Brahms on Thursday's recital by William Kinderman at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, Thursday night, 7:30. He's been my guest on Live and Local today. I'm Kevin Kelly.
Illinois Public Media and WILL stations are sustained through special gifts from people like you who've recognized the value of public media. By naming WILL in your estate plans, you'll make investment in the future of quality news, information, entertainment, and children's programs. For information about our Legacy Society, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or visit online at will.illinois.edu/support.
Here are some of the other events you can go see and hear live over the next couple of days in our listening area, including a recital by another University of Illinois faculty member. Ian Hobson continues his presentation of the complete solo piano works of Robert Schumann. The theme tonight is Fantasies, and it is at the Krannert Center in Urbana at 7:30. Mike Zito plays the blues at the Alamo in Springfield tonight at 8:30. The St. Louis Brass Quintet is at Camp Recital Hall on the Illinois State University campus in Normal tonight at 8 o'clock. It's Frank Parker's Jambalaya Jazz Jam at the Brew House in Springfield this evening at 5:30. The Moscow Festival Ballet has a two-night run at the Krannert Center in Urbana, starting tomorrow night at 7 o'clock with Swan Lake, and then Wednesday at 7 o'clock, three-night run. Wednesday at 7, Swan Lake. Thursday, 7, is The Sleeping Beauty. The Illinois Brass Quintet from the University of Illinois, faculty members there, are at the Krannert Center tomorrow night at 7:30. Denise LaGrassa, singer-songwriter, will be at the Doubletree in Bloomington tomorrow evening at 5. It's the Champaign-Urbana Sweet Adeline's Global Open House at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. I think that's their regular rehearsal time, obviously inviting new folks in there. The Sugar Prophets are at Goodfellas in Pekin playing the blues. That's Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Pianist Reed Alexander, also of the University of Illinois faculty, is at the Krannert Center in Urbana Wednesday night at 7:30. It's the weekly traditional Irish music session at Bentley's Pub in downtown Champaign, Wednesday at 7 o'clock. The Peoria Symphony Orchestra presents its Banker's Hours concert, Over Walls and Bridges, at the GAR Hall in Peoria, Wednesday at noon. And it's Jimmy Bean and Jesse Francis on acoustic guitar and violin at Clark Bar in Champaign, Wednesday evening at 6:30. You're listening to 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR and Classical Music for Central Illinois. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We have support not only from our listeners, but also from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. With wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer, wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. We'll have a cloudy afternoon with scattered flurries and the temperature holding fairly steady in the mid-30s, wind from the west at 25 to 30 miles an hour with gusts to 40 miles an hour. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a low of 22 degrees. Tomorrow, a sunny sky is expected with a high of 35. And then Wednesday, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 30s. We're currently at 34 degrees. It's 12:58. I'm Kevin Kelly. Hope you've enjoyed the show today. I'll be back tomorrow from 12 to 1. And let's hear more music by Johannes Brahms, which we heard earlier in the hour. This is, however, not one of the pieces that Bill Kinderman will be playing on his Thursday recital. This is the fourth of a set of four pieces, Opus 119 by Brahms, probably the best known of that set and one of the best known of his later piano pieces. This is the Rhapsody in E-flat. We'll just hear a portion of it played by Emmanuel Ax.